You're listening to In Network, Nordic's podcast series where we explore healthcare and technology with experts from around the globe.
Hello, and welcome to the In Network podcast feature, Designing for Health. I'm Nordic's Chief Medical Officer, Dr. Craig Joseph. I recently sat down with Dr. Josh Liu, a physician and the founder and CEO of SeamlessMD. We talk about Josh's background in medicine and how he pivoted from a family medicine residency to founding a digital care company. We also discuss how Seamless centers the patient in their design approach, the importance of clinician buy-in, and how to think about the patient journey like a GPS tracking system. Let's plug in. Welcome, Josh Liu.
Hey, Craig. Good to see you.
I am so excited to have you on the pod. You are a famous podcaster. You are a famous social media maven, I believe is your title. You are a physician. You are an entrepreneur. You have done many things, and I'm excited to talk with you about all of those things.
Me too. It's an honor to be here, and I'm excited to dig into it.
All right. Let's start at the beginning. You went to medical school. Where'd you go to medical school?
At the University of Toronto.
The University of Toronto. I've heard of it. And your intention was to become what sort of a doctor? And you know, what was your plan for your life as you were finishing up undergrad and going to medical?
It's funny. So when I started medical school, I thought I wanted to be a neurologist. And then I shadowed some neurologists in my first year. And then immediately I knew it wasn't for me. So I was back to the drawing board. But throughout medical school, I was kind of lost. You know, a lot of folks, I think, go into it knowing what they want to do. I didn't. And what happened was I had this great mentor who said, you know what, Josh, come work with us at this innovation lab and learn about quality and safety and patient experience, like all these topics that I knew nothing about. And I ended up doing some really exciting work on preventing readmissions. And that got me hooked on the quality and safety bug. The tech bug came later, but it started to plant that seed that like, okay, maybe there's something else meant for me in healthcare.
Okay. And so your plans were kind of going off the rails right at that point where you saw all the other things that you could do. So it wasn't so much that you were unhappy with thinking about becoming a neurologist and having an office and shocking people with tiny little needles, because that's my interpretation of what a neurologist does. But you saw all these other opportunities and kind of wanted to explore some of those.
Yeah. And I don't remember exactly what happened, but this is back in, you know, 2010 when this was going on. So, you know, the iPhone came out, you know, 3 years before cloud computing and mobile started becoming a big thing. And then startups in general started to emerge as a hot topic, you know, around me. So I started getting, you know, into that sort of field, at least just like on the peripheries. Actually, in my third year of med school, I tried starting a totally different healthcare tech venture with two buddies from med school. We were all kind of, you know, bit by the startup bug. But that idea, actually, we quit on / gave up on within 4 to 5 months. And the challenge we had was we were all clinical people. So none of us actually had the skill set to build a product or start a business. And so when I thought about maybe doing this again in the future, I knew I would need probably a different team that had skills that I didn't have. And that eventually, you know, led to how we started Seamless. But just know that like these are the stories that people don't hear about, like the failures, the unknown losses, like they happen. We just don't talk about them publicly as much as like the wins and the successes.
Well, let's talk about them. Let me go back just a little bit. So this idea of, oh, you know, we tried starting this company in third year of medical school. Let me emphasize for those non-physicians who are listening to this podcast, it is not typical to think about starting a company in the middle of medical school. You're generally, especially third year, like you're in clinicals, right? You are in the hospital, you're at doctor's offices. And yet you were still thinking about, you know, starting. So were you in high school with like starting companies and, you know, charging? Were you one of those kids in elementary school charging your friends for candy that your mother bought at the bulk food store?
No, I wasn't quite the businessman when I was in kindergarten or anything, but I've always loved being a builder. So when I was in high school, I was really big on projects and starting school clubs and just kind of going from zero to one on just random projects in general. And then when I got to undergrad, actually in my last year of undergrad, long story short, my university went on strike for a few months. So I had nothing to do. And I actually just started a blog where I just started writing articles about, you know, helping kids get into university and applying for scholarships and things like that. It actually originally was meant to help me chronicle applying to med school. I decided I wanted to blog that. But then when my school went on strike, I needed to spend more time writing because I had nothing to do. The strike, we didn't know when it was going to end. It could end at literally any point in time. And so I had all this free time to write. And basically this blog blew up and a lot of students started reading it. And then eventually when I got into med school, I sort of like commercialized the blog and that I ended up, I actually ended up starting a, you know, med school admissions consulting business because I was getting all this traffic to the blog and a lot of students asking me, hey, like, could you help me, you know, read my essays and whatnot and help me learn about getting to med school? So I had a little bit of an entrepreneurial background with projects and like this really small admissions consulting side business. So I've always had that sort of entrepreneurial sense, but I never started an actual like formal company before.
Okay. All right. Well, that's fair. So it sounds like you did kind of build up. It wasn't just out of the blue. All right. So you're looking to, it's now fourth year of medical school. You're looking to graduate. And what were you doing? Did you interview for residencies or were you, you're like, I want to do something else for a bit.
So the plan was to, go actually to family medicine residency. Partially because I think I just realized I was more of a generalist, but the second reason was I figured I would do something like be an entrepreneur somewhere down the line, and having, you know, sort of a shorter residency with more flexibility in the work-life balance would make it easier for me to pursue, you know, other side ventures or projects. So family medicine was a really good fit for me. What happened was, around the, I guess the fall of my fourth year, I ended up actually on a whim applying to the startup incubator. And it was through that incubator that I actually met who ended up being my co-founders for my company, Seamless MD. And basically, I brought the problem that I was studying on preventing readmissions and said, hey, like, you know, wouldn't it be great if we could build something to engage and monitor patients to prevent something like a readmission? And so we had an idea that I was passionate about. I had, you know, two co-founders who came from more of the tech and engineering side. And so, you know, finally felt we had complementary skill sets to go and do something. So we started Seamless MD through the incubator. The incubator actually ran on the side throughout the end of my last year of med school. So basically we were all finishing school while doing the startup on the side with the incubator. And then the way the incubator works is when the summer hits, you come for a few months in person to finish the program. And so initially, even though I'd gotten into family medicine residency, I asked my program director for a few months, you know, of postponing of it to just finish the incubator and then start residency in the fall. And he was like, oh, that's cool. Yeah, go for it. And then as the incubator finished up in August and I had to decide whether I was going back to residency or whether I would do 50-50 time between, you know, Seamless MD and residency, I decided that I wanted to do one thing really well and go all in on just one path. I didn't think I could do two things well. And so I said, okay, well, can I do the startup thing for a year? It's probably going to fail. And I'll be back, you know, starting residency a year later and begging for you to let me through the door again. And they said, okay, sure, take a year, do this, come back. And then every year for 5 years, I would go back and see my program director and he'd say, hey, Josh, are you coming back to start residency this year? And every year I would say, no, I kind of want to see where the startup thing goes. We're still alive as it turns out. And then long story short, after 5 years of this back and forth, my program director steps down from the position, a new person takes over and he says, you know, Josh, this is great. This is really, really neat, but I'm kind of cleaning house, you know. You were his problem. I don't want you to be my problem. So if you don't come back next year, like year six, like that's it. We're not going to keep this back and forth going. And frankly, like I was surprised they let me do this long. I was so grateful. And so it basically became my full-time gig. I never did residency. And yeah, never looked back.
So it sounds like your future as a practicing family doc is quite limited. Although you could still, you know, when you if/when this company that you expect to fail, which hasn't failed now for a long time, you know, if you do really poorly, you can always go back and find a different residency, Josh. So
Craig, I probably need a reference letter from you, because I'll tell you, when I was talking on this topic with that new program director, he said, honestly, Josh, the challenge is, imagine you applied back here and I had to pick between you, who's been out of clinical for years, and this other, you know, applicant who, yes, maybe early in their career, but literally has been doing clinical things constantly for the past few years. Why would I ever pick you?
He was pretty, my goodness. I would come up with 1,000 reasons why someone would pick you over someone who's just graduated from medical school, because you've been interacting in the healthcare space in multiple different ways, and you would bring so much to their residency program. So I will happily write you a letter of recommendation and help you find someone who's a little bit more open than that residency coordinator.
I love it.
Be that as it may, unfortunately for you, Seamless MD is successful. Despite all of your attempts to run it into the ground, you're doing well. So what is, first of all, what is Seamless MD? It sounds like you do something to help minimize readmissions. That at least was your goal at the beginning. Tell us more.
Yeah. So the analogy I like to use is travel. So imagine you're traveling from point A to point B. In the past, you had paper maps, and now we use GPS. And everyone knows GPS is faster, safer, better, and no one would ever go back to paper maps. When you think about a patient care journey, whether that's going through surgery or cancer, maternity care, or something else, that's a far more complicated journey than travel. And yet we still mostly rely on paper and verbal instructions to guide patients. And patients will tell us that they forget these instructions, they lose them, they're hard to follow. And then healthcare providers will tell us that they often feel like they're sending a patient into a black hole between visits or after hospital discharge. And if only there was an easy way to keep patients on track and monitor them to catch things earlier, wouldn't life be better for the patient and for the healthcare system? And so what Seamless MD does is essentially provide a GPS to a patient to go through these complex care journeys. So as a patient, you get Seamless on your phone, your tablet, or desktop computer, and we guide and monitor you step by step throughout those journeys. So for example, Craig, let's say, you know, you were getting major heart surgery. With Seamless, you would get reminders a week before surgery to stop your blood thinners on time, or the night before surgery, we'd prompt you to stop eating on time. The day after surgery, we'd nudge you and educate you on how to do your rehab and recovery exercises. When you go home, we'd ping you to start tracking your symptoms and how you're feeling. You tell us, here's my pain level every day. You take photos of your surgical incision and other important data. And then we send that data back to the healthcare team on dashboards that can also be embedded in the EHR. So they can get alerted, they can monitor you and catch things earlier. We've done this across dozens and dozens of clinical specialties with health systems across North America. And we've seen in over 40 studies or evaluations, really major benefits on lower length of stay, readmissions, ED visits, costs, even mortality. And so the impact on not just the patient experience, but the outcome has been pretty, pretty amazing.
Yeah, it's amazing. And it's amazing to me, I think, for those who are not in healthcare, how many major surgeries are postponed or delayed in some way because patients are not properly prepared. And you mentioned a couple of easy ones, right? Hey, stop taking this, your blood thinner, however many days prior. Because if you accidentally take that pill the night before, you are not having an operation the next day. And that might push you out weeks or months sometimes. And it's certainly not good for the patient. It's also really not good for the healthcare system or for the surgeon, right? Who now has, they have a free OR, which is not something that anyone wants. Right? It's a precious resource. You want to be using it all the time. So that, you know, you're improving the lot of many different groups here. That's great. So where'd you come up with the name Seamless? I mean, it seems pretty cool. Where'd you get that name?
I'll tell you a funny story. So way back when, it was a much more complicated path to getting to Seamless MD. So the very first name formerly we had was Seamless Mobile Health. So it was a 3-word name. We liked the word seamless because at the time, at least, and I think it's still true, there was a lot of excitement around the idea of seamless care, seamless transitions of care. So we loved the word seamless. And at the time, mobile health was this, you know, exciting new emerging field. So we put two and two together. The problem with that name was people would butcher the name all the time. So we'd have, you know, organizations and providers call us Seamless Mobile or Seamless Health or Seamless Health Mobile. So just like even like the wrong order of words. And that started to frustrate me a little bit. But the moment I knew we had to change the name was one day we were meeting with an organization and my co-founder and chief technology officer was also there. And then he got the name of the company wrong in the meeting. And I said, okay, if my co-founder is even having trouble with our company name, it is way, way too complicated. So at that time, a lot of companies in digital health were using the MD term. I think that was just a hot thing. We still have it. You can get a .md domain. So we said, okay, let's just copy what people were doing, call it Seamless MD. To be honest, I probably wouldn't pick that name today. I'd probably go with, I don't know, Seamless Health or just Seamless itself. It was a worse name before. It's a little bit better now and it's kind of stuck.
Well, I think if you were to rename yourselves now, you certainly shouldn't spell Seamless the correct way. That's a given for any sort of startup, right? So maybe S-E-E-M-L-I-S-S or something like that. I'm going to copyright that, but you know, just think about purposeful misspellings. That would be great.
You got it.
So this is a podcast where we like to talk to people about design and its overlap with healthcare. And so certainly this is something that you must have been concerned with. I'm assuming that you don't just kind of sit down and start coding and saying, well, this is how people are going to use our app and how physicians are going to interpret the information or the care team in general. So talk to us a little bit about how design works at Seamless MD.
Yeah, I think from the very beginning, we had this patient-centered design approach. Throughout the entire process, whether it was even just ideating the solution or even just prototyping and testing it, we'd always make sure that patients were involved in different ways. And I think it's very important to us is recognizing that it's not just about age or demographics of patients. Like it's very obvious, I think, to most people that, yes, you want to test your product on folks in their 60s, 70s, 80s, 90s for accessibility and usability. But even down to the clinical specialty level, we found to be important. So whenever we, let's say, design a digital program for a brand new clinical area, we always make sure to actually interview, patients who have gone or are going through that health condition or surgery type and ask them questions such as, what are you most worried about in this journey? What information did you wish you knew at the beginning of this journey? What questions did you have? What fears did you have? And that information on top of the actual, literature clinically, that gets infused into how we design the experiences. So I think just being very laser focused on the patient is key. Probably one story that comes to mind that I think helped me really understand the value of working with patients is, initially we did a lot of work on just the mobile platform. So smartphones and tablets. And I remember, we used to very often just go into the hospital and actually sit next to the patients and show them, prototypes of the application and just watch how they would interact with the program. What buttons would they press? Was it intuitive? Because we wouldn't be there when they were using it, right? So it had to be pretty intuitive. And I remember there was this elderly patient that was sitting next to, and this hospital was going to be using Seamless for hip and knee replacement. And so she was going to have her hip or knee replaced, and she pulls out her iPad from her purse. And so I'm like, great, she's a tablet, she can access this, it's going to be wonderful. And then she tries to download the application. And she can't because she doesn't know her App Store password. And so I ask her, I'm like, well, what do you use your iPad for if it's not to download apps and use them? She's like, oh, I use it for email and I love surfing the web. And I was like, oh boy, you know, like if I just looked at the device she had, I would have made this huge assumption that of course she can use a mobile app. That was not true for her at all. And so that was actually a very important driver for us to eventually have a web-based platform as well, because we find even today there are a lot of folks, especially older folks, who have devices, but they actually prefer the web-based version of the product. And so meeting patients where they are is such a huge learning for us. And we only would have known that if we had actually sat next to patients and just watched them.
Yeah, this story is, I've heard over and over, yet startups, I think even established companies forget this regularly. We had another interviewee on this podcast who mentioned that a program at her hospital wasn't working well and people weren't leveraging the technology that they were creating and no one could understand why. And so she decided to, like you, actually go to the, go to the clinic, hang out in the waiting room, try to understand what was going on, and quickly learned that almost everyone in the clinic spoke Spanish and that the directions for how to download the app were solely in English. And it was that little change that, made all the difference by saying, oh, well, the app didn't really need any work. It was just the instructions on how to access the app, putting it in the language of your audience or your group of patients is essential. Also reminds me of, Jack Welch. I think one of the things he talked about was management by walking around, right? Mm-hmm. He felt it was very important to actually get down on the factory floor. And so he didn't have to listen to what information that he got that was kind of went up through the ranks, actually hearing from the folks that are doing the work and what their ideas are and what their frustrations are.
Craig, I think that's a great point in the sense that I think a lot of times people think about the product experience starting once you're in the product, but you're absolutely right that the experience starts during the onboarding or even just during the educational process, because if they can't even get to the product, there's no product experience.
Yeah. And I have to admit, I would have done the same thing that you were doing. I would have said, here's this great app that you cannot download because you just don't know how to, and you're not interested in that. And you know how to use the web browser and you're super happy to do that. And it should all just work that way. So yeah, you got to meet people where they're at. So how big is Seamless MD? How many employees do you have?
Yeah. So we have 33 full-time right now. And we work with 50 different hospitals and health systems across North America.
Okay. And when we were preparing for this, you had mentioned to me that you thought some of your secret sauce. I asked you for all of your secret sauce, but you'd only give me, wisely so, you'd only give me a small part of your secret sauce, was having clinicians in the company. You said a big chunk of your folks have real world clinical experience, and you thought it made a difference. Tell me how.
Yeah, so when I think people talk about healthcare companies having clinical DNA, they often think it starts and stops with having like a chief medical officer. And to me, that's just one person. I think clinical DNA has to be a lot more widespread for clinical views to have an impact on how you design the product and how you work with your end users. So we actually have over 20% of the company coming from the clinical world in some way. So we have folks who, let's say, are pharmacists or dietitians or health communication specialists. And that's really important because even though on the outside, it looks like we just have more of a patient-facing consumer solution, we actually provide very much, I call it a clinical solution. So, when we guide patients through these healthcare journeys, all the content, the workflows, the algorithms have to actually be aligned with and signed off on by the frontline clinical staff. Because if what we're educating and telling a patient to do does not match what their clinical teams want them to do, they're not going to be promoting the solution to their patients. It has to match, it has to fit the workflow. And so when we implement, so number one, our clinical teams actually design all our evidence-based digital programs. And when we actually implement it with frontline providers and departments, because it's such a high quality evidence-based program, they typically say, wow, you know, this oncology care journey, we love 80% of it. We have to tweak 20% because our health system does things slightly differently, but at least we're 80% of the way there. And that last 20%, our team actually does the heavy lifting on configuring and customizing it based on what the clinical teams want. And so the clinical teams are like editors, and our clinical team is like the ghostwriter, because again, like, you know, as a clinician, your time is so short, right? You're so busy with patients and other things going on. So if you can just tell us, change this, change that, but we understand what you're talking about, we know the clinical lingo, that makes a huge difference in making it easier for your team to implement our solution. I can tell you, we have all kinds of partners who've said, you know, when we first heard that the hospital was bringing in, you know, a technology solution, we were like, oh my gosh, yet another vendor who doesn't understand what we need as a clinical team and how we speak and how we write. But when we met Seamless, we got to work with actual clinical people. They understood what we needed, what we wanted. It was so much easier. And I think people often underinvest on the clinical side when it comes to healthcare tech, but I think now it's actually pretty integral to doing it well.
Yeah, my only disagreement with you is saying that chief medical officer is not the most important by far. Since that's the title I have, I want to say once again, for my boss who may be listening, that chief medical officer is the most important position.
Totally.
However, thank you, Josh, for clarifying that. Don, if you're listening, Josh just clarified. However, you're so, I mean, I've experienced that so many times. And in fact, I used to work for a big EHR vendor. And one of the things that I saw firsthand was physicians who were in mandatory training, who did not want to be in mandatory training. That's just a given. Whatever it was you're training them on, they're not that interested in it. They'd rather be doing their job. Would be looking for reasons to kind of discount the trainer, right? And so here's a very specific example that I saw happen. A trainer's trying to explain to a physician who's never really used an electronic health record before, or has never entered an order, and they just want to show them how to enter an order. So they say, oh, well, you go to this box, and let's say your patient has a cold, and so you want to prescribe an antibiotic. So you go into this box, and boom, we're done, right? I'm like, you're done. Well, why? Well, because you just said to the doctor that the patient had a cold, which we're going to presume is a viral upper respiratory tract infection for which an antibiotic would not be indicated. And you've just told me that, you know, me, the doctor, that you don't understand healthcare. You don't understand basic science, right? And if you don't understand those things, why would I trust you to tell me how to admit a patient using your tool? Your tool can't be that well designed or, you know, useful to me because you don't even understand what I do. You don't even understand that I wouldn't order an antibiotic. And again, from the trainer's perspective, a non-clinician, but someone who is very good at adult learning and, you know, explaining how that works, just thought, well, it doesn't matter. You're ordering a medicine. I'm just trying to show you how to order any medicine. But it does matter. And those clinical experiences are like gold. So, and you have to pay for them with gold, I guess. But, you know, you find over and over, especially with doctors. I think others are a little bit more understanding. Doctors have a chip on their shoulders. I think I can say that as a physician.
Well, you're correct. It's such a good point. So I think, you know, when you come from the pure tech world, you think you're just selling features. And so in your mind, it's, well, the feature worked as intended. You click the button did something. But when you talk to clinicians, you realize that the context, the scenario, the use case really matters, because even if the features work, if the clinical algorithms, the workflows are wrong, the results can either at best just be frustrating, at worst could be devastating. And to your point, like if you break that trust early with the clinician, why would they trust you in anything else? It's very rational if you come from the clinical world to understand that for sure.
Yeah, it got to the point where when we were selling, you know, I'm essentially selling software, but to your point, it's clinical software. I saw people get into arguments about what antibiotic, you know, like, oh, I would never choose that antibiotic for community acquired pneumonia. And I was like, now we've gone a little too far. Right? So let's figure out an example where we don't have infectious disease specialists arguing over what the best antibiotic is for the kind of bacteria that we're seeing in our community, because that does get a little bit much.
It's so funny because you're right. Because I can tell you, even with us in the past, like there were times where we were showcasing, we call it just an example, but then clinicians would be like, no, wait, hold on. But that doesn't make sense because I would not do it that way. And as a vendor, you're like, well, it's just an example. But for you, it's like, no. But then you get kind of, you gravitate towards the clinical side. So we also have gone smarter about, okay, let's just not use examples that there may be disputes about. It's just not worth it.
Anything that's even remotely controversial, I don't want to go down that path. Because again, and I said this to a CIO once who said, after I told her this, she's like, you must now speak to my entire department. I said kind of just offhandedly, I'm like, generally, we know that, I say we physicians, our attitude is that you guys from IT don't know what you're doing. We just can't prove it yet. You know, our starting position is that you don't understand us. You probably don't even understand your own tech. And that's just my, my personal, not just mine, but I think it's a commonly held belief. And now we're just looking for data points to support our theory, right? And so when you say things that make me question reasonably that you understand what I do, then I'm like, ah, I was right. This person doesn't know anything.
Exactly.
So let's talk about selling. So you have to sell your technology, your platform into hospitals and healthcare systems. And sometimes the audience doesn't include clinicians or physicians specifically. And you've told me that there's a good story about kind of going down the wrong path when you thought you were going down the right path.
Yeah. So I think for a long time, we always try to find the fastest way to get into an organization, because as everyone knows, sales cycles in healthcare can be very, very long. And so one time, many, many years ago, we were actually able to sell Seamless to a hospital without having to talk to any physicians. There was, a quality leader in the organization who saw the value in the solution, convinced, the executives to buy the product. They bought the product. And we're like, great, this was one of the fastest sales cycles in the history of the company. And then when we started implementing the solution and had to actually start working with the physicians and the frontline nurses to get this going, that's when all the trouble started, because the physicians and the nurses, very understandably so, were saying, well, what is the solution? Like, we didn't know about this. We didn't agree to this. We don't even know why we have to do this. And long story short, it was a very unsuccessful implementation. Clinicians were not engaged to, promote it to patients and use it. And soon after, unfortunately, we lost them as a customer. And from there, we learned that actually, when it comes to clinical solutions, you can't skip steps. Clinician buy-in is so critical because they're the ones who actually need to be engaged with the product, who need to promote it to patients and use it. And so now, whenever we go through the sales process, even if we meet a health system who says, hey, we don't have to engage the physicians, you have our buy-in top down, let's just go ahead and do it. We'll say, no. Like, we need to engage them now, because what we don't want to happen is you sign up for this, implementation fails because your clinicians don't buy into it. And then you've wasted your time and money, and so did we. And I don't care if the CEO of this health system wants this. If the frontline staff aren't bought in and aren't educated, it's not going to work. It's just a waste of time and money. And so I think we learned the hard way that buy-in cannot be skipped. And in fact, it's actually better if they buy in early, because then they feel like they own the initiative, and then they're far more engaged the lifetime of the partnership. So it's a little bit of, obviously extended time at the beginning, but it pays in dividends over the long haul.
Yeah, there are things you didn't learn in medical school, and you didn't learn in your startup courses or innovation centers. And it's the school of hard knocks where it's important to make sure that you know the right audience, even when the right audience seems to be right in front of you. And those are the people with the checkbooks, but it's also the people with the white coats and the stethoscopes as well. So that's good stuff. let me pivot a little bit to how we met. And so you and I have met through social media, really. And I told you when I started speaking with you that you're a guru on social media, on LinkedIn and other sites. And I'm wondering how you got, you know, how do you decide to post things, and how do you write things so that they're eye-catching and not superficial? Because I'm in awe of your ability to do so. So I'm just, give me the secret sauce. Maybe not all of it, but some of it.
Well, thank you, Craig. That's honestly very kind of you to say. I really appreciate it. I think there's a few things that I've learned, and actually it came from, I think, just reading about other people, about what actually gets folks excited and engaged. So here's what works for me. So one is, I don't know who came up with this, but the idea was that really good content does one of three things. It either educates, inspires, or entertains. And so I try to live by getting to one of those three buckets if I can. I think the second thing for me is that it's really important that it's authentic to me, that I enjoy writing about. It's a topic that I find exciting and I care about. Actually, when I started doing this, some folks actually asked me, like, hey, Josh, are you actually writing this stuff? Or like, did you hire a ghostwriter, et cetera? And I was like, I write all myself. And like, I would never like hire a ghostwriter, because then it just won't be authentic and it wouldn't be me. I think you got to do it yourself. I think the other thing that's worked for me is when I started writing more seriously, I actually wrote down a list of about 10 points of views that I had, like high level points of views that I have, some of which are controversial, or at least very, very narrow in thinking. And some people would disagree with them, which is great. And then that way I always had some points of view that I could always go back to and write about that are authentic to me. So for example, Craig, one of my points of view, which might be a bit controversial, is I think in digital health, pilots are a waste of time and you need to design implementations from the perspective of scale from day one. You may end up discontinuing the solution, but if you design it as purely a pilot with no plan for what happens afterwards, I think it's set up for failure. So I hate the word pilot for many reasons. A lot of folks think pilots are okay. They're good. It's a great word. And so I may, you know, disagree with folks, but I think having a point of view, I think, is a very powerful thing. The last thing I'll just say is that I've learned is the hook or the first line of the piece is the most important. People have very, very low attention spans. If you can't capture attention in the first sentence, you lose the person completely. They're going to scroll on to the next thing in their feed. And so I'm very thoughtful about, okay, like what is something about this piece that could have in the very first line that's going to make Craig stop and go, oh, I need to take a closer look at this for at least like 10 more seconds.
That is a lot of secrets that are kind of obvious after you say them, but not obvious beforehand. So thank you for sharing that. That's great. I too write all of my own stuff. I will admit that ethically, I lapsed once or twice. A blog post, I had someone said, oh, I can, let me, you know, help you write that. And they wrote it. And I was like, oh, yeah, it's pretty good, and put it out there. And I just kind of had a tsunami of criticism from people. Right?
That wasn't me.
It wasn't you. It was a long time ago. But like, they were like, why didn't you talk about this? And why did you say that? And this sounds kind of vanilla. And I violated just a bunch of the rules that you just, you know, just enumerated for us, not on purpose, but yeah, the message that they weren't giving to me was, but indirectly I got was, this is not you. We know it's not you because you did a bunch of things here that we don't expect. And so, yeah, I think that's a big difference right there. So. Awesome. Well, Josh, we are near the end. And as you may know, at the end of this podcast, we always like to ask our interviewees, that's my term for you right now, what are some of the things in life that are so well designed, maybe one or two, I don't need a long list, so well designed, they bring you joy and happiness. First, the answer always people give is this podcast. So let's go past this podcast and go on to other things that maybe are not so obvious? Are there one or two things that are so well designed?
I was going to say your podcast, Craig, but
thank you.
I'll go to option two just because you said so.
Thank you. I appreciate it. I'm trying to be more reserved and, you know,
you're just so humble. So, you know, you want
that, that too. A lot of people say that.
Yeah, I bet. So I have a really nerdy answer, but it's authentic to me. So I'll share this with you. Many years ago, there was a calendar app for your phone. It was called Sunrise. I love this app. It was the best calendar app I'd ever used. Then one day, Microsoft acquires it. And eventually, they kill it. They sunset the Sunrise app. That's actually kind of funny.
That is ironic right there.
There you go. And then they basically folded into the Outlook app. And at first, so basically, I'm sure everyone here has probably used Outlook, where if you open up the Outlook app, you have your inbox for your mail, and then there's a tab for your calendar. And when that first happened, I was so upset. I was like, oh, I lost my favorite calendar app. And I'm like, why are they putting the calendar in the mail app? I mean, there's a reason why there's two different apps for mail and for the calendar. And like, I'm so confused as to why they did this. And eventually I got it, because as I started doing more work on Outlook, and I had to go back and forth between my calendar and my inbox to schedule meetings, and it was now just one tab away instead of flipping through two different apps, I was like, oh my gosh, like my life is so much better through how they designed this now and integrate the two. And I just learned that, you know what, a lot of times, like, great product designers uncover things that even as a consumer, I didn't even think about. I never even thought, like, oh, this should be in the same app. My life would be so much better until I experienced it. And so that's my nerdy story of how I found Outlook to somehow be one of my favorite apps.
This is a first. This is a first.
I figured it would be.
that point is very well taken. And I think most of us are, you know, we don't like change because we're humans, and change scares us. And so when anything changes, unless it's clearly solving a huge problem for us, we don't like it. And I think that's part of the designer's purpose in life, is to kind of look beyond what we say we want and give us what we need. And that's not always easily done. In fact, it's rarely easily done. You, with the as a designer, whether you want to call yourself a designer or not, you lead a software company. You're doing design. It's the same thing. Like, you've got to really not ask folks, what kind of app should we design? You have to find out what their problems are, and then to design the app to solve those problems in an efficient way. And it may be a way that they've never contemplated before, and might be a way that they really dislike when they first start using it. And so you, to your point, like, hey, what, I think one of the great questions that you asked some of the patients that you're working with, what do you wish you would have known at the onset? And as you were talking about that, I was thinking, you know, a lot of people, even if you tell them what, even if someone says, this is what I wish I would have known, and then you tell that to someone who's about to have that procedure or that experience, sometimes they're just not ready to hear it. And there's just nothing you can do except give that information and kind of and hope for the best. But that's a designer's dilemma there. Well, it was great. And if Microsoft wants to support this podcast, we are always open to that. And we'll use you on the TV commercials, maybe for probably too late for this year's big event, like a Super Bowl or some other championship. But we'll try again for next year. Dr. Josh Liu, it was great having you. Thank you so much for explaining how your company works, what cool things you're doing, and how we can all be better at communicating, not just on social media, but almost anywhere. Thank you so much.
Thanks, Craig. It was great to be here.
Thanks for tuning in. We hope you enjoyed today's episode. For more information about Josh and Seamless, visit seamless.md. Check back for more episodes of Designing for Health wherever you listen to podcasts or on nordicglobal.com. Until next time, we'll see you in network. If you enjoyed this episode, please leave us a 5-star rating and a review. This helps others find the podcast as well.